You're listening to Holocaust survivor Mel Fedderbusch, interviewed by his son on the occasion of his 90th birthday. Mr. Fedderbusch spent much of his adult life not speaking about his horrific experiences in order to safeguard the feelings of his family. Today, after having 5 grandchildren, he has agreed to reveal the details they've never heard. On this broadcast, Mr. Fedderbusch discusses the concentration camps and death camps at Buchenwald, Triglitz, and Theresienstadt. He reveals details about living in the Polish ghettos and working as a slave laborer for the Nazis. He shares his harrowing experience of being falsely arrested and placed in solitary confinement, and his personal account of the murder of his parents and 9-year-old twin sisters, plus his heroic attempt to save his own life by leaping from a Nazi cattle car headed for the infamous death camp, Auschwitz. Mr. Fedderbusch's testimony and original Buchenwald passport can be viewed at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York. His eyewitness accounts can be accessed in the Fortunoff Archives at Yale University and at the Shoah Visual History Foundation, founded by Steven Spielberg. He's a speaker with the Holocaust and Human Rights Education Center in Purchase, New York, where he visits high school students, bringing his message of perpetual hope, global peace, and the end of prejudice. He's an adamant proponent of patriotism for the United States of America and support for her ally in freedom, liberty, and democracy, the State of Israel. This unprecedented live global broadcast is brought to you by TalkRadioX.com. And now, here's your host, Greg Fedderbusch.
Okay, it's hour 7, and we are together in Wellington, Florida, on December 27th, 2013. And what we're going to do first is answer some questions from people who wrote in. One person is our wonderful cousin, Stephanie Altman Singer. And she wanted to know about after the liberation, how did you leave the farm and where did you go? I thought you told me a little bit about that. You went with that girl, the German girl, tell me the town again. She was going somewhere and
to Leipzig. But before I'm answering the question, I'd like to say something about Stephanie Singer. Stephanie Singer's mother and father, were very, very dear to me. The mother, Sylvia, was a wonderful, wonderful person. And I had a very, very good understanding with her, even though we met late in our lives, but it felt like I am cousins, that we know each other from childhood on. Stephanie's father, Aaron, was a wonderful person, a good friend, a person who would give his shirt off his back, always ready to help. And I love them both dearly. I really miss them. Stephanie, I'm very happy to answer your questions. I remember being at your 16th...
Sweet 16.
Sweet 16th party. I'll never forget the restaurant on 57th Street. I really had a lot of fun, very good memories. So, Stephanie, now I'm coming to your questions.
So you met this girl...
Well, it wasn't so sad. I was still on the farm, and Germany was still in power. It was about 3 months before the end of the war, which was about March 1945. It was after dinner. We were sitting in the living room with my farmer and his family. I think we were listening to the radio. And this beautiful girl walked in, and she reminded me a great deal of a girl that I knew from my hometown. But of course, she was German.
Well, you told this part of the story.
And I told, well, I'm just coming back to it. Well, anyway, I couldn't, there was no, it was against the law for a non-German to even talk to a German woman because of they considered themselves the master race. The master race, right. And it really was against the law, so I didn't even bother to talk to her. But I really had very nice, she made a great impression on me. As soon as the war was over, I walked over across the street. And she came with her family from Leipzig. They were, not deported. They sent them there for safety because of the bombings. The Allied bombings. So for safety.
Relocated.
So they relocated these people for safety. That's why she was there. But she was originally from Leipzig, and she was studying music, the violin, and the most famous conservatory in Leipzig, which I understand. Very, very famous, important composers like Mendelssohn and other German composers were studying at the same conservatory. Well, to make a long story short, we became acquainted and we decided, and I told her, I'm going to Buchenwald, and she said she's coming along to go to Leipzig, which is apparently on the way. And it was a very, very long and difficult trip because all the transportation, all the bridges were bombed and destroyed. All the railroads didn't work, no buses. We just kept on hitchhiking, and we saw a farmer with a farmer's horse and wagon. And little by little, we advanced to Leipzig. And on the trip, we became very close friends, very close. Well, we finally, and she decided to come with me to Buchenwald and change her name to a Jewish name. She came to Buchenwald, we both came to Buchenwald, and this was a few weeks after the liberation. And there was a Swiss Red Cross was there to invite us to invite surviving children at the age of 16 to go on for rehab to Switzerland.
Up to the age of 16?
Yeah, up to the age of 16 or younger. And I was not accepted because I was already 21 years old at that time. My brother, however, was accepted.
Sydney.
And so with that, my girlfriend was also accepted.
What was her name again?
Her German name was Sylvia Ufer, and her Jewish name was, that she adopted, was Jenny Binderfield. The name is, was, she got she knew of a girlfriend in Leipzig, a Jewish girl. We don't know what happened to her. Well, anyway, I spoke to this Rabbi Schechter, who was a chaplain in the American army, and he helped he helped the Swiss Red Cross to get to put the list to get together those kids at the age of 16 to go to Switzerland. And so I approached him and I told him that I was not accepted. So he said, don't worry about it, Melvin. I will take care of this. You will not be separated from your brother anymore.
Now, when you met him, you met Rabbi Schechter again in 1990-something in New York. You called him.
7 years ago. That must be...
was 2000,
2007.
2006, 2007. Did you remind him of this story? He didn't remember you, did he?
Well, he thinks he remembered me, but we didn't talk much about that. He didn't, of course, he remembered, he knew, of course, that he was in Buchenwald when Buchenwald was liberated. As a matter of fact, he came in an hour after the General Patton's tanks broke into Buchenwald and liberated it. He came in an hour later, and he was screaming in Yiddish, "Yidden, ihr seid frei," that means Jews, you are free. And this is, he wrote a nice article about this, and he kept on talking about this over the years. So we didn't have to talk much whether he knew me or not. I was part of the people that he helped. And when we met for the reunion, he only loved to talk Yiddish to me. And so we spoke in Yiddish. But, so anyway, he did take care of me. He did go to Switzerland. It was my brother. And my brother went to the United States about 3 years after we got to Switzerland. And I also on some kind of a special consideration for younger people. And I was too old for that also, so I did not go. I had to wait for the American, for their visa, which is for the Polish Quarter. The Polish Quarter took about 5 to 6 years at that time.
Polish Quarter?
Quarter.
Oh, quota.
Quarter. And it did take 5 to 6 years.
Oh, so that's why he was in the States way before you.
Exactly.
So he came in 45? It was.
No, he came 3 years later, like 48.
So you spent 6 years in Switzerland. There must have been something interesting, this is where you had to get your life back together. Wasn't it an important time for you?
It was a very important time for me because when we came out after 6 years in concentration camps and ghettos, we have to learn how to live in a civilized society. And the 6 years in Switzerland put me back into... gave me the education to live in a civilized society.
What did you do there?
Well, I worked. The first 2 years we spent, I spent in Lugano in a Hachshara, which is a preparation to go to Israel. And
but where did you live?
I lived in a castle.
Why?
Because it was big enough to accommodate 200 or close to 200 boys and girls who came to Switzerland together. And most of them wanted to go to Israel. And this Jewish organization somehow made an arrangement to teach us farming and everything, and trades of all kinds.
What organization?
Jewish organization. It was a lot of Jewish organizations were involved, like Hayas, and I was an instructor myself, and I taught other kids, younger kids, woodworking.
You didn't tell me that. Cool.
Yes, I was an instructor, and. This was 2 years. After that, most of these kids went to Israel illegally on the Exodus, on the famous Exodus. And I didn't go because my plans were to go to America because my brother was already there. He was the only one alive who survived. And so I was waiting for the Polish visa.
Were you in contact with him while he was in America and you were still in Switzerland?
Of course, yes. We corresponded via letters. And eventually I got the visa and I went to the United States. and here in the United States to start a new life. It was, now we're coming back to what I did. Mm-hmm. In the United States at that time, this, which was October 1950, it was a difficult time economically in the United States, and it was very difficult to get a job. Very difficult. I finally decided to go into my own business. But before that, I did find a job. I worked on a job, and I made $3.50 an hour.
That was much more than minimum wage, wasn't it?
Yes, but I also worked for minimum wage before that, 75 cents an hour. And I'll never forget, I made $20-some dollars for the week, net after taxes, and I took out a girl at a date. And we went, she was from Riverside Drive in New York and 70-some Street. And it was within walking distance to go to the park, to Central Park, where the restaurant over there called Tavern on the Green. And I took the girl to Tavern on the Green for dinner. She was a very wealthy girl. And I spent wages on that date.
$20.
About $25 or $26.
How did you meet her? Where did you meet her?
I can't remember exactly how I met her,
Did you belong to any organizations when you got to the States?
Yes, I belonged to the. First of all, we had our own organization, the Dambrina, and I met her through some people. I can't remember exactly how I met her, but this girl was a. Was, I understand, very, very, from a very rich family. And while I was working on the job, which I made about $3.50 an hour.
What job? Was this the window?
On picture frames, no. Oh. Picture frames on 54th Street. The name of the company was Royal Art. They're no longer in existence. 54th Street at that time was not like today. They had low old houses, today, of course, you have skyscrapers.
54th and what?
54th between 6th and 7th Avenue.
Oh, yeah, there was huge buildings
there. Between Broadway and 7th or 6th and 7th Avenue. Mm-hmm. And now, they, of course, it's the theater district. And I was working there, and I was quite happy. I noticed a piece of paper near the wastebasket. I decided to take the piece of paper and throw it into the wastebasket. You know, it turned out to be a letter, a copy of a letter, that my boss wrote to a company in France, begging for more frames. He was importing frames from there. And so I was very curious to know what frames these are. So I walked over to my boss. He was a young guy. And I said, Herbie, his name was Herb Diamond. Herbie, which one are the frames that you're begging for,
from that begging? Frenchman?
Yes. He was importing them, and he wanted more frames. He says he can sell them, and please send me more frames. So he showed me, these are the frames in the showroom there. I looked at the frame. I said, why can't we make it here? He said, well, everybody tried to copy it. No way. Nobody was successful copying it. You know, it's the finish. It's a family secret in France, and the artists and the collectors love that. And we can't copy it.
Is there a style or a name that you could put on this?
Yes, the name was Decapé. That was the name of the finish. And the finish looked like an old house, a wall of an old house, which is peeling, the paint is peeling, and different colors are coming through, and so on. A peeling effect.
Yeah, distressed.
Call it decapé. So I said, Herb, let me try. I said, I'll try and see. I didn't think I could do it, but I wanted to try. And I did try a couple of times, and the third or fourth time, I had it
came out exactly like the French finish.
And what was it that you did to create that? What type of material?
Well, it was a question of different paints, how strong the paints are and how weak. We got different layers, you know, to simulate the that old wall. And it came out perfectly. I had in mind to go into business anyway. So I went into business.
Wait a minute. So you showed it to them, and what did they say?
Wait a minute.
Your boss.
First I went into business. But I didn't show it to him yet. I went into business first. It took a few weeks, maybe 6 or 7 weeks after that. I was already in business established in Hempstead.
So you just rented a store?
Rented a store.
You started mixing these paints?
And I bought some woodworking machinery to make frames, to cut the wood and everything else. As a matter of fact, what I found an old Jewish man by the name of Levinson who had a shop on 3rd Avenue, and he had machinery to do the carving. So I gave him the frame, the French frames, and we took them apart, and he was able to duplicate the carving. And then I got the carving, and I cut them to size, assembled them, and I put that decoupe finish on. And I made the first few frames. I sent a sample, one frame down, my previous boss, Herbie Diamond. And he called me, and he insulted me at first. He called me an SOB. I says, "What do you mean? Why are you insulting me?" He says, "Because it's not fair. I told you everything. You took away my source in France." I said, "Herbie, I made those frames myself. They're not coming from France." "Oh, you're full of baloney." I says, "The back of the frame, and you'll see it's made out of basswood, American basswood, not like the cheap pine that's coming in from Europe." And he looked and he says, "Oh, you're right. Well, my God, they're fantastic. How many can you make a week?" I said, "I can start with about 200. The carving was no problem. Mr. Levinson did the carving. I hired a few people. They didn't have to be skilled. The secret was in the mixing of the paint and then in the final finish." And he says, "How much do you think an average frame will cost?" I said, "Well, I already figured it out. I can tell you right now it's going to cost about $20 a piece, average." He says, "Well, I'll take everything you can make."
How much less was that than what he was paying?
It cost me $10 to make it.
Well, what was he paying?
I don't know, but he agreed to the price right away.
He's probably paying a lot more. He had to pay for shipping and everything.
Shipping, probably. He bought all the frames I could make. I was 27, 28 years old, and I was making at that time 200 frames at $10 a piece net profit. And that was equal to like $2,000 a week, which was the highest. Even a executive on Wall Street. In fact, I didn't even know what to do with that money. So I finally found out, and I invested it in the stock market. But this was going on, and that's how I established my business.
Who told you about the stock market? Do you remember?
Oh, I knew about the stock market, even in Switzerland. I had a friend in Switzerland, an older couple who liked me. They had no children, and they are sort of like adopted me, like, and I gave him all the money, and this man put the money on the stock market, and I made money on the stock market even when he was in Switzerland.
So when you came to the States, you already had money.
I had $5,000 when I came to the States.
And you had to bring it with you, or it was here?
I transferred the money through a bank. When I got here, I walked into the bank and I got the money, if I wanted to. But I put it into savings. Greg, I didn't come from a...
Well, you just said, that's why I'm asking, because you said, I found out about the stock market. That's what you said.
So yes, yes.
Maybe you just learned about
it. Well, no. Well, that's true. Maybe I found out about different stocks and so on. I was well established in business when I became a citizen 5 years after I arrived in the United States, which was 1956. My plan when I first came to the United States, I had a dream. I wanted to go become a citizen first and go back to Europe as an American tourist. And now that I had the passport, and of course I had enough money, and money was no problem, and I was well established in business, I had a manager, and of course this was July, and July was off season anyway.
Tell me about what it was like to get a visa. Was it a difficult, not a visa, your citizenship?
Citizenship was no problem because they had a green card, and then when the time came, they advised me that to come to swear to become a citizen.
Didn't you have to take a test or anything?
Yeah, we took a test also, yes, an English test. And we had to also about the American history, and a test about the American history, and I sort of knew enough to pass the test. And I don't remember if I needed a visa to go as an American to Switzerland. I mean, to Europe. But I decided to go to Europe on a business trip, which was a fulfilled my dream as what I wanted.
Did you have somebody there you wanted to see that you were already doing business with?
Yes, I knew. Yeah, I did some business already with some people in Holland and in Belgium. And this is the way I went, I was on my way. But on my way on the airplane, at that time they were not, we had the propeller-driven airplanes. We didn't have jets yet in 1956. So it took a long time of travel. First we had to go to Rome. And from Rome I would probably took a train and go to Belgium. But on the way, there were a lot of young people going to Israel. And they came from different organizations. Not everybody knew each other.
What airline was this?
I can't remember that.
Was it an American airline or was it a...
Must have been an American airline.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it was... No, it was not LL. It was an American airline.
Probably TWA or...
I can't remember. It must have been. And we sang on the airplane all these Hebrew songs, Zionist songs. And of course, these people, they were about my age and younger and so on, a combination of different young people. They thought I was going to Israel also, of course. When they found out I'm not, they were disappointed. So I said, you know, I always wanted to go to Israel from childhood on. So I decided in the spur of the moment to go to Israel. When we got to Rome, I called long distance my manager, and I told him, Kenneth, I decided to go to Israel for a few days. I know it's not that busy because it's off-season, if you don't mind. He says, no, it's okay, go, do whatever you like. And I decided to go to Israel for a week. And when I got to Israel, I called up a friend of mine who I knew from Switzerland. He was married to a Czechoslovakian girl. His name was Ferry, his first name.
Ferry,
yeah, a Hungarian name. And he was married to a Czechoslovakian girl, and as soon as I called him, he right away invited me to dinner. This was about the second day after I got to Israel.
What month was this?
July. This I know. And when I got there, your mother was invited to dinner also.
How did she know them?
His wife was Czechoslovakian, and they knew each other because your mother is from Czechoslovakia. They apparently knew each other from their hometown or whatever. And She spoke, your mother, she spoke English because she came from England. She worked as a secretary in England. And I proposed to her within 15 minutes.
No, you did not.
Yes, I did.
At the same dinner?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, your mother did not agree.
Oh.
She didn't accept.
So you met her, so you both started speaking to each other immediately in English.
Of course.
And what did you guys talk about? Like, what was the topic of yours?
All kinds, about America.
But did you find your mother
didn't like American tourists over there in Israel. She called them old ladies, and they were very noisy, and they were dressed like young girls, and, you know, they did not know of such things in Israel. An old lady was an old lady. An old lady from America, it pretends to be young, and that she didn't like that.
Hello?
Are you, hello?
Is this Gregory, my favorite cousin?
How are you?
I'm good. I'm here with Lisa.
And Melvin's and, here, too. Say hello.
Oh, Melvin. Oh, my goodness. Hello, Melvin.
Hi, Shirley. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Lisa and I have been listening to your recordings, and I can't tell you how emotional I was. How do you comfort someone?
Well,
you never be comforted.
Well,
you remembered everything.
Well,
like
I don't
it
know.
Happened yesterday, clearly.
I am blessed with a good memory. Thank God.
More than blessed. It's amazing. After 90 years. I wanted to ask just one question. I said to Lisa, the question I had in mind, I hope it was not ridiculous, but the question I had in mind is, your day by day, do you ever have a free day that you don't think what happened to you as a youth?
Yeah, well, I really don't think about it as much as I used to. As time goes on, it gets to be further and further and further. You know, at this point, it's like a dream, like a
bad distant, memory,
like a bad memory, a distant dream, sort of. You know.
Wow!
It is important because nature is such that other things become more important, such as your wife, your family, your children, your grandchildren, your relatives such as you. All these things take over, you know. And so, and the bad things sort of, thank God, sort of stays in the background. Right, exactly.
That you're able to see.
By the way,
well,
Shirley.
What, darling?
Say, you got to be very, very careful what you're saying because you're being recorded.
She knows that.
I think I know, but I just have to say, Lisa and I, when we sit there, Shabbos, we're making Shabbos, we didn't listen to every recorder, every program.
Thank you.
But the last few, we sat and made Shabbos together, and we listened to you speak. It was so elegant. I can't believe how you remember such details.
Well,
so many years ago.
They are.
So many years.
I am sure that there are more details that I didn't mention because it would take it took a lifetime.
Many more.
It would take a lot longer to record everything that's really happened.
Well, you know, you lived a life, a childhood. You really had a hideous childhood. But you outgrew it. You went on, and you went on. Where many people are not capable of going on, but you did, and you become successful. And I have to add a little note. Your success also brought you very kindness to people. And I remember one incident, my daughter, who needed help when she was in college. And you helped her without a question, with any condition. You just helped her, And she was able to finish school because of you, your kindness. And she became a very educated lady. And I know you like educated people.
Right.
And I have to tell you, I appreciated every moment. I thank you.
It was my pleasure. And I'm glad that Lisa is what she is. She's a wonderful. She's a wonderful.
Yes, I don't know what would have happened. Maybe she would have, but it was so. In 2 minutes, you helped her without even thinking. And believe me, Melvin, my Sadie thanks you, and I thank you forever. I love you, and I appreciate everything that you've ever done, and that you're a relative. And Baruch Hashem. We found each other,
thank you.
Wonderful that day was.
Thank you.
Being in Grandview Terrace, and all our symptoms we shared together, and that was wonderful and memorable. It's good things that you remember, hopefully you remember just the good. Anyways, that's it. How have you been?
I remember even when I first met you, when I came with Sylvia, may she rest in peace, to Albany, with Elsa, and
yes.
We slept over in your house, and
right.
And
Mark, my son was 2 years old.
He was 2 years old, and I remember getting up and playing with him outside.
Yes,
you know. So thank God, and to me, to find your relatives like you, all of you, it was like finding a gold mine. Surely, we are continuing. There'll be more.
we hope to see and hear all of them.
It never
hear every one of them.
It never ends.
I don't want to miss any. We just sat and just listened to your voice, and it was so good. And Melvin and Gregory, he's pretty good in his job too, interviewing.
No. Thank you.
He's very good too.
That's nice.
Anyways, I say goodnight, and I wish you well.
Love you, Shirley.
And with many blessings and lots of love.
Thank you, Shirley.
Take care.
Happy New Year.
Thank you, Shirley, and Happy New Year to you and your family.
Hi, and a happy and a wonderful New Year to all of you.
Love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We love you. Bye-bye.
Love you back.
So, you believed in God when you were young.
Of course you believed in God. During the Holocaust and the ghettos and concentration camps, and we saw the killings and the suffering of the people, and I started questioning whether it's possible that God would allow these things to happen to us. I'm still questioning it.
Huh.
And I don't know if I'll ever find an answer, but I feel that since the way it's written in our scriptures that we all were created in the image of God, so that means every one of us has God in his heart, and every one of us is part of God. And that's what I believe in. If most of the people are really nice, and they're good, and therefore God is in these people, in us.
Do you think God was in the Nazis?
If God would be in the Nazis, they would not do these terrible things. That's what I believe in.
You think maybe that there was a lack of learning about God at that time?
On the Nazi part, the Nazis?
Yeah, the Germans.
Whether they knew about God, they were cultured and educated people. They called themselves the most cultured nation in the world. In fact, they thought they were the Germans are superior to all other nations. Obviously, they knew all about God, and in spite of it, they did the terrible things that they did. In fact, from what I understand, they tried to create a brand new religion, a Nazi religion, where Hitler would replace Christ. And
they spoke about that?
Yes. They were looking for the Holy Grail, and they were trying to prove very hard that what they believe in is the right thing.
So they were trying to prove that Hitler was part of prophecy?
Prophecy, that he is sort of like a
second Messiah,
like a Messiah for the Germans. In fact, he was so successful when he occupied all of Europe that they really thought, the Germans, that Hitler is a Messiah to them.
What about the effects of the Holocaust on your outlook about world leaders today? Do you think the Holocaust had an effect?
On the world leaders at the time of the Holocaust. We know that there was no one around to help. As a matter of fact, Hitler said in one of his speeches that he must be doing something right because nobody is complaining. It is a fact that no country in the world wanted to accept the Jews. To the Jews, there was a situation where a ship from Germany with Jews came. The name was St. Louis. The name of the ship was St. Louis. All of German Jews tried to escape from Hitler. They were afraid. This, I don't know exactly the year, but must have been like 1940, 41, when Hitler was this was at the time of the Holocaust. They apparently knew how dangerous it was to stay in Germany, so they left without visas and they couldn't get visas to go to the United States. So they left without the visas. They bought or rented a ship and called St. Louis, and they came all the way to the United States, and the United States did not accept them. Then they went to Cuba. Cuba did not accept them. Eventually, they had no choice. They had to return back to Germany, and very few of those people survived.
Did they die on the ship, or did they die when
they got back? No, they had to come. They came back. They went back to Germany, some of them maybe to Belgium, and all of them eventually wound up in the concentration camps. And very few, there were several hundred people on the ship, with children and elderly people, and very few. When I say few, it's only people, maybe less than 10, survived the Holocaust.
10 people or 10%?
Less than 10 people.
Less than 10 from that ship. What have you done to communicate your experience to young people who have not been affected by the Holocaust? And what is your message for future generations?
Well, I am doing everything possible as a Holocaust survivor to talk to organizations, to synagogue, churches, and mostly to high school children about the Holocaust. I make them understand, of course, they all want to know what it was like and how I feel. Typical questions. And
like what? What else? Like how you feel? Like these questions?
Like all these questions. That's typical. But I will say that the high school children today are educated and they are fully aware of what the Holocaust was like. And so my time, and I'm aware that what they know, and so I'm not going to, don't have speeches about the Holocaust itself. So what I'm doing is I am asking them, I devote most of the time to answering their questions specifically. And that's what I'm doing.
Another one of their questions is, how do you feel about German people today?
Well, I feel towards the German people today that I do not have any blame against them, of the Germans today. I do blame, however, the German people of the time of the Holocaust, because at that time, I would say 99.9% did support and believed in Hitler, and supported him to the last minute. It is amazing to me that a cultured people would devote their time and their energy and follow orders the way they did. And some of these things that Hitler ordered were really not sensible. And like killing so many people, they did follow, they did do it. And then they blamed the fact that they had to fill out, they had to do the orders that they received, and that's why they. I do not believe that there is any reason for killing other people, no matter who gives the order. And I'm sure every sensible person would think that way. So basically, that's what it is.
Did you ever experience any Nazis who were compassionate or who gave you a break?
No, not really.
They all were just...
They followed their orders. We had to follow what they told us. And if you know what the Holocaust was, I don't have to tell you about how horrible it was and about the killing and about the persecutions and the beating and the terrible stuff that they did. But they did it, and they did not even express any kind of anything that they would be against it. There was no such thing. They would say that they were afraid of them. What? Afraid of Hitler? I mean, I don't accept this as an excuse. Because if they would honestly wanted to do something against it, they could have done it like all other nations. If they don't like anything,
Groups protest?
Groups, individuals, whatever.
What about the Germans who were not Nazis?
That's what they say. My opinion is that they were all Nazis up until the end of the war.
They all followed along.
All followed. We do not know of any kind of resistance until we know. Yes, there was in 1944, there was an attempt to assassinate Hitler by a German officer, and it was not successful. This was a very, very isolated case. As a matter of fact, as soon as he survived, and they knew that Hitler survived, they immediately followed all his orders or policies, even though he no longer made any sense, and he was no longer was in the right state of mind, and yet they followed it anyway. That's how much they believed in him.
He made them feel that they were important, and that they were the, and that if they
made them feel that they are the superior nation, and that they deserve to have the Russians and other nations be slaves to the German nations. And they were looking at what they called Lebensraum. Lebensraum means more room for the Germans. More room meaning more farms, more space, more everything. And the way Hitler writes in his book Mein Kampf, which is my struggle, he outlines exactly, the books are available even today, he outlines exactly what he was going to do, and he really outlines and he says that Germany should occupy all Eastern European nations, including Russia, and enslave them, and he actually writes it that way, so that the superior nation of Germany are entitled, because they are superior to everything. That was the idea, and that's what he's trying to do, and the Germans believed in it till the last minute.
And what about Holocaust deniers?
That became a problem. But being a survivor, and I'm 90 years old, I'm doing everything possible for many, many years to make sure that the Holocaust was a fact. When I talk to people, to organizations, to high school children and so on, we are telling them as a person who survived it, and they, of course, I am a witness who survived the Holocaust, and of course, this is the best proof to convince the people that the Holocaust was in fact there. We have opened up museums. We have written books, thousands of them. We have built monuments. We have talked about it. There's no way an educated person or a person of any common sense would believe a denier saying that it didn't happen. There's nothing else they can say. We, however, have the proof. I lived it, so therefore, there's not a person in this world can come and say that it did not happen. It just makes absolutely no sense.
What do you think your life would have been like? Did you ever think about what your life would have been like if the Holocaust never happened, if the war never broke out?
The life in Poland, where I come from, was not great. The standard of living was very low. Most of the people were poor. Now that I live in the United States for so many years, this kind of life, I realized that even the rich in Poland were poor by comparison to the standard I'm accustomed to see here in the States. So I always, since childhood, wanted to leave Poland, wanted to go to at that time was Palestine, before Israel became an independent country. And it is quite possible that if without the war, I would have gone to Israel.
When you went to Israel in 1956, and you first arrived there, how did you feel? What did you want to see? What did you think?
I felt that it's the best thing that happened in 2,000 years to the Jewish people. We have been suffering against prejudice, anti-Semitism, pogroms, and all kinds of things, which is well known in our history, and we were being killed for. As a matter of fact, there are statistics available today that if the Jews wouldn't have been killed over the years, we would have had today 100 million Jews, wow. While the actual amount of Jews today is 12 million. Hmm. So that would have made some difference.
You also once said to me that that Israel was actually one of the good things that came out of the Holocaust. Like maybe it sped up.
Well, I don't think it came out because of the Holocaust, because Zionism started with Theodor Herzl, which is going back to the turn of the century, and I remember I was a Zionist when I was 10 years old. My father was a Zionist. And the Zionist organizations were very strong, even before the war. So the desire to have an independent country was very, very strong among Jewish people. It's possible. In fact, the Balfour Declaration was given to Chaim Weizmann in England in 1917. So it isn't because of the Holocaust. It's because we wanted an independent country, because we did not, anti-Semitism and prejudice against us was much too much, and we suffered. And it's been 2,000 years, and when Israel became independent, it was the greatest miracle that happened. When I came to Israel in 1956 for the first time in my life, and I saw, before we landed, before the airplane landed, the people on the airplane were so screaming out of joy, out of enthusiasm, when we saw the Israeli land. It was just incredible, hard to explain. And when I saw it, actually, when I landed, and I saw the everything that's going on, a Jewish country, Israel, it was just incredible. I still think it's incredible. It's a dream fulfilled.
And how what do you think about the country today?
Greater than ever. Greater than ever. I'm glad. I'm 90 years old. I'm glad if I die even tomorrow.
Definitely.
I am glad to know that there is an Israel, a Jewish independent country.
What would you think about, did you ever think about moving to Israel?
Yes, when I was...
I mean, not when you were a kid, like in your adult years.
No. Since I came to the United States, I gave up that idea because I was much too busy. We came out from the concentration camp, and I was much too busy to establish a life here. And as you know, we were only two of us, my brother and I, who survived. And... we were just busy to establish ourselves here with a family and so on. And that was the priority.
What would you think if one of your grandchildren decided to move to Israel?
I would love it.
Yeah?
I would have nothing against it.
You wouldn't be worried?
No. Not at all. I would be proud of him, as a matter of fact, if that would happen.
No, and what about the girls?
Same way.
How would you describe your own characteristics that have helped you accomplish what you have in life?
Well, my characteristics are quite obvious. My brother and I are the only survivors of the entire family. We were about 70 people. It was very important to me, as well as to my brother, to establish ourselves, establish families. And so, therefore, it was when we came to the United States, we worked very hard to establish ourselves. And today, thank God, I have a son and a daughter who, in turn, gave me the most wonderful grandchildren.
Do you see any miracles in life?
Yes, every day is a miracle. Especially to me. Every day is beautiful and every day is a miracle, and I see almost many miracles each day and every day.
What are the values that you want to impart to your children?
To be good people. Good. Good all around. A good person is a good person. We know what a good person stands for. To be a mensch. And that's important. I want them to have an education. I want them to have nice families. I want them to treat people nicely and live a good life.
Is there anything else that you would like to do besides go back to Demblin?
No, I don't want to go back to Demblin.
Yes, you do.
Yes, I want, I guess for a day.
Just for a day. No longer than one day.
Day is enough.
That's a long trip for one day.
But I would like to go and make sure, somehow, make an attempt to get back my house that my father worked so hard for it. I will never forget how he built the house. And he didn't have any money, but all kinds of people owed him money for the furniture that he made for them. And... I remember there was one person with an empty lot, so he took the lot in exchange for the loan, for the money that the person owed him. Then they were others. There was another person who couldn't pay, so he gave him old bricks. I remember I was 6-7 years old when I cleaned the old cement from the bricks to get ready to build a house. It was cold outside, unbelievably cold, and I cleaned those bricks. My brother was even younger, and he did it too. Then we built the house. My father worked very, very hard to do all the doors and windows and everything else. I remember when the roof was done, I can't remember exactly how he paid for the roof, but it was done somehow.
How long did it take to build the house?
Well, it took a couple of years. But the first thing they did was to move in with the factory, even before it was finished to live in. And then when it was finished to live in, we moved in. And I remember the last day before the war broke out, which was on a Friday, the 1st of September 1939, I remember the mason finished the stove. They built a stove there. Unlike today, you buy a stove, you put it in. Those days, they built a stove out of bricks and with an oven in it and with wood-burning stove. They used coal also. And they finally finished that day on Friday. And my mother was so happy that she'll be able to bake bread and other stuff and cook that stuff, which I'll never forget the happiness. And the next day, the war broke out. And 11 days later, they got killed from the bombs. Today, the Polish government does not want to return any of the Jewish properties. And that house that my father worked so hard for, I cannot get it back. And it isn't such a big or expensive house, but it's the house that was paid for with blood money. As a kid, I saw that, and that hurts.
What would you do with the house? I mean, it's just the idea of getting it back.
No, I would sell it.
What do you have the address?
Of course.
You don't know it off the top of your head?
Yes, I do.
What is it?
It's called Demblin, and it was on the street, which is called Ulica in Poland, Ulica Warszawska, meaning Warsaw Street, number 72.
Oh.
Yep. And I'm not even talking about the property that belonged to my grandfather. Oh, nobody survived. It's also mine. Under normal circumstances, I'm just talking about my father's house.
What would you, this student says that his grandmother won't talk about the Holocaust, and he wants to know how can he get her to talk about it?
I would not pursue it or force her to talk about it. Apparently she's in pain. And it's quite possible that she feels that she may cause pain to you by talking about the Holocaust. So I will not pursue it. There are many other ways how to find out people who were with her or people who were from the same town and suffered the same way. And some of them maybe wrote books on the subject. I would pursue this information from these other different sources instead. And I would not make her feel bad.
If you have anything that you need to know that was brought up and that you need elaboration on, please email us at melsurvived. That's melsurvived@aol.com. And we'll include it. We'll see you next time.